Hello there and welcome to Marketing Room 101, the podcast where I invite marketers to join me for a good old rant and give them the chance to banish one thing from the industry forever. I'm your host, Ben Norman, Strategy Director at Principles in Leeds, and I'm joined this week by Jordan Stacchini. Now, Jordan is the founder of Co & Co, an agency in Manchester that describes itself as no fluff, no bull, just mega marketing, which she set up on her own just a month before the COVID pandemic struck, and has since then grown the successful agency that she herself admits was never really supposed to be an agency at all. I wanted to invite Jordan into Marketing Room 101 as she's refreshingly unfiltered in how she talks about marketing. She doesn't try and make what she does sound any more complicated than it really is, and she seems to take her own advice about not being afraid to have an opinion, which I think comes through in this episode. So here's my conversation in Marketing Room 101 with Jordan Stacchini. Jordan, welcome to Marketing Room 101.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. So to kick us off, can you please describe the room to our listeners? What's it actually like in here in Marketing Room 101?
So there's a few things going on. There's people screaming for guaranteed results.
Of course.
Champagnes.
Yeah.
There's people running around like headless chickens crying about AI. And there's quite a few PR people in here as well.
Okay, so break these down for me. So we've got the people asking for guaranteed results.
Yes.
But potentially we'll get onto that a little bit more later, but you've got the PR people in here. Why are the PR people in here?
So it's not, I know a lot of people in PR and they're lovely people. It's the discipline that I think I struggle with because I think PR has changed. You know, PR ultimately is creating a narrative for something. Think now, the world that we live in, you know, the fact that everybody has a phone in their hand, everybody has the power to capture something, everybody has the opportunity to create a narrative. And I just don't really know what the place is now for traditional PR. I think traditional PR is now really obvious as well. People know when they're being spun. Maybe I have a tainted view of PR and I just see it as being that's not quite as good as marketing. But yeah, there's a few PR people in here.
I think it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you've got the PR in a... I think PR has a lot of power, but I also think I agree with you that the old school PR that hasn't moved with the times, that hasn't moved with... Like, PR and social should be attached at the hip, shouldn't they? In the same way that I get really pissed off when people try and draw a line between we're digital or we're not digital, we're online or we're offline. It's like, how can you consider them in isolation these days? Like, digital PR, people seem to believe it's just getting mentions or building backlinks or whatever it might be. Yeah. Whereas actually, you know, it could be appearing on Lab Bible. Traditional PR, is it just writing old school press releases and trying to get a bit of coverage?
Yeah.
It needs to move on, doesn't it? And I get what you're saying there.
It is difficult, yeah. And I think that maybe it's because of the space we're in and maybe we can see it 10 foot away. But I just think PR, paid for PR, is really obvious. And ultimately, PR, the idea is to influence or is to change a perception largely, isn't it? And it's to create a story around something. It has never been easier to connect with individuals en masse. And I think that is where traditional PR now falls down the cracks because you can go out and build a profile for yourself, build a personal brand for yourself without spending any money, you know, from your bedroom, if you like, just using the tools that you have in your phone. And where does that leave the role then for PR in doing that for you? So I agree with you. I think that the digital world and the offline world, I don't think they are separate. I just think they're, you know, maybe two different planes in the same universe. But you can be as offline as you like. Someone will capture it and put it online. And then is it now online marketing if someone sees it and does something because they've seen your offline activation or whatever captured and put online? So
yeah, and I thought we'll let them come back to you individually over time as well. So you're the founder of Co & Co here in an unusually sunny Manchester today.
Oh, I don't know. We've had some cracking weather recently.
Yeah, just every time I come over, I know it's a cliche, but every time I come over the hill to Manchester, it seems to piss it down.
We have a big sign in our office. It's on our website as well, actually. And it's in every deck that we do that says, you can keep your blue sky thinking we were born in Manchester where great things happen in the rain.
I love that. Yeah. So you set Co & Co up when you just turned 30.
Yeah, a few months after.
So you did it on your own?
I did.
And it happened to also be the month before COVID.
Yeah, so I registered the business in February 2020. And then March 2020, we all went into lockdown for 2 weeks. Do you remember that?
Of course. Yeah, can't forget it.
Multiple years. So yeah, I mean, obviously wasn't in the plan for a global pandemic to come along.
No.
But it did. And we just had to roll with it, really.
And then fast forward 5 years later, we're sat here in this office and
you're running a successful business. Is this how you imagined it turning out? What did you imagine it turning out? And how does that compare to where you are now? And what's been the toughest point in that journey for you? Because it can't have been all easy, right?
No. So just to go to your first point, no, this is absolutely not how I saw it turning out. When I started Co & Co, while I gave the business a name, it was only ever meant to be me. Co & Co actually stands for consultants and collaborators. Mm. And I'd built a really successful career. Obviously, you touched on the fact that I started the business at 30. I'd done really well up until that point where I'd become head of Europe and Africa for one property investment company by the time I was 28. I left there for a global role, kind of a bring your bag of tricks and do the same thing for us. And I knew I didn't want to keep doing that. I knew I was 30 and, you know, potentially had 20, 30 years more ahead of me of doing that. And that wasn't really lighting my fire. So through conversations with various people, quickly realised that what all these people wanted from me was strategy. Mm. And if they needed, you know, certain people, certain skill sets to come in and execute that, whether that be PPC or SEO or a new website or something that I couldn't do, then I could ultimately consult for them, collaborate with other people to make that happen. So that's where Co & Co came from. So yes, I gave it a name, but it was only ever meant to be me, kitchen table, a few days a week. And just a bit of a lifestyle business, really. It sounds lovely. Doesn't it? It sounds great. Yeah. But that's not what happened. And yeah, we've grown organically. We've grown through necessity. And what I mean by that is we've had more inquiries and therefore I've needed more help. I never set out to build an agency. Now I'm setting out to build an agency to sell. So yeah, it's not anything like what I imagined it would be like. And making those decisions to grow and that kind of thing were not ones that I took lightly because, you know, while I was okay with being responsible for my mortgage being paid and all of my finances, being responsible for other people's is a different ballgame. So we've grown steady, we've grown slow. And when I was starting out and when I kind of got to that point where I realized I can't do this on my own now, I'm going to have to grow it at least, you know, by a few people. I sat down with somebody and he gave me the best advice I've ever been given in business. And that was, you can grow in two ways. You can either grow with speed or you can grow with stability. And I've chosen stability every single time. That is what I chose. I didn't choose the scale, exit. You know, the people that work with me are really important. And, you know, as I say, my plan is eventually to sell this, but we're not talking, you know, a few years, we're talking maybe 10 years. But what happens to the people that are here when that happens really matters to me. And having no plan and just making good, solid decisions along the way has done me okay so far. So I think I'll keep with that strategy.
Yeah. There's a lot to be said as well for having a very, very strong business with fewer people than there is having, like you say, the chaos of growing into being 50 people, 100 people, whatever it might be, the chaos that comes with that and the potential risk to your clients, the risk to the people that work here, the risk to the culture.
Yeah. And the mental health that I've suffered in the past, and I'm happy to talk about with mental health, and, you know, have really gone to a place of burnout. One of the things that kind of annoys me, I don't know if it would be in marketing room 101, but it's certainly been my room 101, is people that confuse stress with burnout.
Yeah.
I'm stressed as a person. I run a business. I'm responsible for a lot of stuff. That is stressful. Have a stressful life. Have a lot going on. You can manage that. And actually, that kind of stress is a bit of a privilege. Burnout is something totally different. Burnout is a feeling that you don't know if you will survive it. And that is different. And having been there is no way that I would put myself back in a situation that would potentially bring that on again. Why would I do that to myself?
I've had a similar experience. It's interesting what you've touched on, because I've not heard anybody really define it in that way. But when I think about previous places I've been in work, but then I also compare them to the impact that might have had on relationships I've been in, and it's burnout is never a good thing, but I am a person who really gravitates towards stress.
Same.
I love stress. I think stress can be great. I don't think we should be shielding people from stress.
Yeah.
I think we're all afraid that stress is you can't put that young person under stress. Like, stress is how we grow. It's how we improve, right?
And there's healthy stress.
I don't think burnout's ever a good thing.
It's not. And as I say, that is how I define it in my head, is that stress is manageable pressure. Mm. And you should always feel a stretch, I think. Like, I definitely feel that when I feel that stretch, I'm like, okay, this is growth now, because I'm going up a level. Yeah. And I love that feeling. And I hope that I have created a culture and an atmosphere where everyone feels that stretch, but also feels the support around them to make that next step. But yeah, burnout is a feeling of I don't know how I'm going to survive this. And it's interesting what you say there about gravitating to kind of towards that stress, because I actually ended up going and having quite a long time with a therapist to help deal with the burnout. And she said to me, you are someone who thrives in chaos, and actually what you need to be comfortable with is the calm. And I don't do well with calm, because I'm always waiting for the chaos, because that's where I feel comfortable. So yeah, that was a real journey to go on. But going back to your point, anything that might put me back in a position of that, there's no way that I would do it to myself.
So if we take a step back a little bit, if we go back about 10 years, 15 years, however long it actually is now, I think we seem to have quite a similar experience in our early careers. I understand you did quite a monotonous, really grown-up job in a contact centre before you ever started out in marketing.
I mean, I wouldn't call it a grown-up job, but it wasn't monotonous.
it was the sort of job that grown-ups were doing around
there was a lot of grown-ups around me doing
And it, equally, I dropped out of college when I was 16, and I went and worked at a BMW dealership in the service department for about 2.5 years. And I essentially spent my days dealing with angry rich people with broken cars, which was quite an eye-opener.
Funny enough, I ended up dealing with angry poor people with broken trains.
So we've both dealt with angry people at a young age. You've talked about the almost the fear that came when you looked by the side of you that I'd experienced as well, of seeing the people that clock in, clock out, and have been doing that job for 20 years, 30 years, whatever it might be. To what extent do you think that experience influenced your career and where you kind of are now?
I think it's massive. I think for me, it goes a bit further back than that. So at school, I was always, you'd call me academic. I didn't really have to try. It wasn't like A stars, but I was certainly A's, B's without really trying in my GCSEs. And I loved school. I loved learning. I still love learning. And I did well. Got two older sisters, again, very academic. And I guess the expectation was, well, you'll just follow suit. You'll go and do your A-levels, you go to uni. My dad came from a very different background to us where, left school at 15, joined the army. And his whole thing was, I never want any of you to have to work as hard as I did for what I got. So he was always like, stay in education, get it in your pocket, and then no one can take it away from you. So at 15, when the college from about an hour away, came to school, and the girls from the beauty courses came in, and I went home at 15 and told my dad that I wanted to be a hairdresser. He met me with a no, you fucking not. And that wasn't anything against hairdressers. It was you picking a really hard line for yourself here, because, you know, starting wage is low. It's graft. Go to sixth form, get your A-levels. If you still want to do it, people are still going to need their haircut, and you can do it then. And I resisted that for a long time. But in doing that, I found media. And in media, we did a module on advertising, and I loved that. And I found out I was basically really good at, like, persuasion. And I thought, okay, if I can do this for a job, then this is cool. But after that point, I've been in education, I felt, for a really long time, and I needed a break. So I said to my mum and dad that I wanted to kind of bum around Thailand for a bit before I went to uni. I got my place and I deferred it. And they were cool with that. But in that, because of the kind of work ethic, I guess, it was put into us by our mum and dad, it was, okay, if you want to go and bum around Thailand, that's fine, but you're going to have to pay for that. Again, great learning curve, because what jobs are there for you to do? And, you know, you're 18, they're mundane, they're not massively exciting. There was no such thing as social media then, so I couldn't go and get a job, you know, doing content creation or anything. So I went and worked in a contact centre, and I was the person, because I had a GCSE in English, that people wrote, and I mean wrote, physical letters to for National Rail complaining. And it was just the most boring job ever. And like you say, I was seeing people come in, day out, and this was their job. And they'd done it for 10 years. They'd done it for 15 years. They'd done it because their mum worked there, and then they worked there, and their cousin worked there. And I just, you know, everyone is different. Horses for courses. People all want different things. But I knew that that was never going to be enough for me. And while I still had a plan of, right, I'm going to go to uni and I want to go work in this thing called advertising, I think what that job did is gave me a bit of fear. If I don't go and follow what I want to do and do well at it, then I could end up back doing something like this where I've just walked into it.
And that stress that you talked about, I think that's the thing that I'd missed at some point in that role. Fine, I could do the job, I got paid a wage, that sort of stuff, but did I get that buzz of the stress that I get in my job now? Like, I think I knew I needed that in some way.
Yeah, that you're right. There's that feeling, isn't there? Like, I had a day like it yesterday where I was so busy. I feel like every meeting I had or every conversation I had, I moved the dial in every single one of them. And I went home fucked. I was knackered last night. I think I was asleep by like 8:30. But that feeling of like when I was walking back to the car last night and I was just like, I've really fucking done some work today.
So if we, moving on to where we are right now, and you really, really bang the drum for ROI obsession.
Yeah.
I like your statement that if you're not measuring, you're not marketing. But I often think there's that fine line, isn't there, between letting data drive the car and data be the fuel in the tank is, you know, I know you're a fan of an analogy, so that's throwing one in there. How can brands be ROI obsessed and measurement led or measurement powered, but also still make sure there's that room for magic, the room for that creative idea that you can just feel in your gut? How can we make sure that the ROI obsession doesn't stop them from having that moment of magic?
Yeah, and you know, the ROI obsession thing is absolutely not meant to dampen anyone's powder or, you know, be the party pooper. Ultimately, that ROI obsession is the strategy bit.
Yeah.
So the great idea and what it looks like is the execution. As long as that execution is happening in front of the right audience at the right time with the right amount of spend behind it on the right channels, they are all the things you measure. So as long as you can measure the execution, not that I don't care what it looks like, but that is secondary to me. So for me, we always start with what is it you're actually trying to achieve? One of the things with ROI that we really have to help people overcome is that everybody thinks ROI is related to a sale. It's related to someone handing you money for a product or service that you offer. And that's not true. And that's where people fall down, because ROI is just the measure of activity versus spend you've put in. So, you know, things that you might want to achieve are, it might be sales, it might be driving footfall, it might be getting more people to your website, it might be downloading content, it might be signing up to a newsletter, it might be increasing followers. That is your objective. Then you work out how do you make that happen? And then you work out how much money you're going to put into it. What it then looks like can be as fucking creative as you want it to be. And, you know, we were talking before about the conversation and talk that I'd listened to of, forget his name now, apologies, but the lead designer at Surreal, who used to be Innocent. And he was being asked in this talk that I was listening to about, you know, how are you able to get away with being so creative? And he said, it's very simple. We've never tried to relate what we do on social and organic to sales. So yes, we measure engagement, we measure followers, we measure all of those metrics that people might call vanity metrics. But if they disappeared tomorrow, you wouldn't call them vanity metrics anymore. We measure those. And that is how we measure the success of our organic.
Yeah.
The sales is something else. And that is brilliant. And I wish more people thought of it like that, because not every single activity you do has to put money into the till today. It might do, but it might not be the thing that happens straight away. And that's where the strategy comes in. You take a 12-month strategy, you're not going to do everything all at once over the 12 months. You're going to drip feed things, and you're going to do peaks and troughs of different activity. That's strategy. So that's kind of the ROI thing. You can have magic. You can have, if anything, we try and encourage people, and we say to everyone we work with, we're really going to force you to be brave here, because we do our best work with people that want to be different and want to move the needle. But we will also make sure that this works, because it can look good, but does it work?
I think that's a really, really good way of wrapping up that whole piece around ROI. And I've mentioned to people in the past, I've got this massive list of things that I want to put in my marketing room 101. If I ever do an episode where I just interview myself. But one of those things is this idea that you're either ROI obsessed and a performance marketer, or you're an outdated brand building marketer who doesn't understand numbers. And it's like, actually, no, that conversation is more nuanced nowadays.
Yeah, definitely.
You can do both. You can do creativity and performance.
And I think you absolutely have to, because one can't exist without the other.
No. So I think that has moved on. I think that's a really good way of summarising it. So the time has come for you to banish something from the marketing industry. Can you tell me, John, what would you like to banish, please?
So there's two things I would like to banish. The first one, anybody that works with us or works with me will not be surprised, but it's exclamation marks.
Right.
And the reason for that is I had a lecturer at uni who just burned into my head that if you have to use an exclamation mark, you haven't said what you think you've said in the right way. So rewrite it. So I hate exclamation marks. No tone of voice we've ever created would have an exclamation mark in. Nobody is allowed to use exclamation marks when they send emails to me. That sounds really diva-ish and nasty, but I can't stand them. And yeah, I make people rewrite things all the time if I spot one. So I would like to put them in. The other thing that I would like to put in is just this guff about how AI is going to take all the creative jobs, because just think that is Well, it's very dangerous, but it's very short-sighted as well.
So let's pick into exclamation marks, because I've just become conscious, now you've mentioned that I've probably sent you quite a few in emails. I agree with you, but I use them personally, but I would never use one for a piece of brand communication, I think. So maybe I need to I need to address that in
outlaw them completely.
So your point about exclamation marks is that you can write it better. You can make the point without needing to tell people and making a point.
We're in the industry of telling stories and getting messages across and trying to persuade and influence people within 2.5 seconds. If you cannot write a line of copy or a sentence that does that without an exclamation mark, you need to go and work in PR. You need to go and do something else because you don't have to write.
Yeah. Okay. So is there anything else? So if we think about punctuation and grammar, because exclamation marks we can take in, but is there anything else that you think we need to rule out? What about emojis when they're used in copy?
So emojis I'm actually all right with as long as it is appropriate for the brand.
Yeah.
I use emojis in all of my LinkedIn posts and things like that. And we use them in other clients' stuff where it is appropriate. That's not to say everyone should be throwing aubergine emojis over everything, but there is a time and a place for them. I don't know. Maybe emojis will get to that point later down the line where they are the bad grammar. But yeah, I actually don't mind an emoji.
So we're thinking about exclamation marks, but we're also, you mentioned about AI there.
Yeah.
But you're not saying you want to get rid of AI. You're saying you want to get rid of the fear of AI. Talk to me a little bit more about that. Where's this come from?
Yeah, so there's a few things, right? So I saw a post a while ago now by somebody, and they are in the industry, and they wrote a post on LinkedIn, and the first line was, all creative jobs are going to be gone in the next 10 years because I was able to create this with AI. Anyway, I read the rest of the guff, and the picture was an AI-created poster, and it had a line of copy, it had a picture of this lad's tea from the night before, and it was put together in a pretty creative way. You would say it'd been put together on Photoshop or Canva or whatever, but, you know, it'd been put together. Now, my issue is not that he was able to do that in 10 minutes. That doesn't surprise me. My issue is he thinks that was good enough because the line of copy was instantly forgettable.
Yep.
The picture was pretty shit. And the whole thing was just meh. Like, it was just not... Yep. I didn't look at it and think, wow, like, that's really impressive and quite scary. I looked at it and thought, what's your point? I'm not impressed by this. And I think that there's just this, it can do this, therefore it's going to take everyone's jobs. When actually I think AI will serve a purpose for reducing costs where people don't have the money to spend on a human doing the job. So for example, you could go out today and you could go and buy a Billy bookcase from IKEA for 90 quid that has been mass produced. Anyone can have it. It can come off the production line in about 3 minutes and it will go up in about 30 minutes, depending on how good you are at flat pack. That's fine. That serves a purpose. Loads of people out there have got 90 quid to spend on a shelf and no one's bothered about everyone having it as well. You could also go and have a shelf built by a master craftsman. It's going to cost you 10 times the amount. It's going to be one of a kind. It's going to be a story to it. It's going to be exactly how you want. You're going to be involved in the process of it. And it's probably going to last longer. That is exactly the same for me when it comes to AI and creative. There will always be a place for a cheaper option, but there will always be a demand for quality and one-off and uniqueness and that no one else has this. Like, that is human nature to want to be like that. The bit that does worry me is the kind of lower levels of creatives, that there are some agencies out there, and I have seen things written about this, that are doing away with junior level creatives because they're using AI to do a lot of the idea generation. And in agencies, you find, I'm talking big, wholly creative agencies now, they tend to use the juniors to come up loads and loads of ideas, and then that gets escalated to the designer, the middleweight, the creative director, etc. It goes up that process. Now, there are people saying we could get away with not having these 20 juniors in and using AI. The problem with that is, how do you fill the next layer of creatives and the next layer? And how do you create creative directors for the future if your entry level point is going to be done by a machine? Because you can't jump over that fence and go in at middleweight or creative director or, you know, senior designer or anything like that. You have to have cut your teeth and you have to have learned the trade. My worry is it creates a problem later down the line. So it might solve an issue now, but we're going to have no creatives in 20, 25 years. Not because AI did them out of a job, because creatives decided to get rid of a layer of people that feed the next layer.
100%. I think the way that we're approaching this as an industry, or the way that many are approaching it, is potentially self-sacrificing. We're potentially cutting off our face to spite our nose with AI. And I think it's, going back to your original point about this, if you think AI is going to take your job, or you think AI is going to take everybody's jobs, what you're probably showing is that you don't really understand, or you don't have a great grasp of what creativity is, of what great communications are. Because if you think it's just production, then you're showing that you don't understand the value of human creativity, human ideas, reflecting a genuine human insight. The only time I've ever been wowed by AI, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, is in just how accurately it can create something that looks real, but it can't create the backstory of that actor and the reason why we like that actor. I've seen it recreate.
It can't make connection.
Yeah. And it, you know, if you think about someone who created something where it looked just like Brad Pitt, and they're like, well, we don't need Brad Pitt anymore. Yeah, but we like Brad Pitt, or we like X other actor because we followed like their career, we know the backstory, we connect to that human, you know, and I think that's the same with music.
There's no way if you created a band today, there is no way that that band could have the same impact that Oasis have just had in Manchester for the past 10 days, because that's connection.
Yeah.
And I think that that is the one thing that we need to remember, is that it cannot replace that. And I think the people that do think, oh, we don't need Brad Pitt anymore, or we don't need Oasis anymore, or whoever, that is actually really, really scary, not in a professional sense, but in a personal sense. Because if you're then saying to people, you don't need other people, you can create these people and have relationships with them and, you know, form some sort of communication with them, they're not real. You're not going to have the same interactions you have with a person. An AI is not going to disagree with you. It's not going to argue with you. It's going to try and please you because you created it and you've coded it to be the way you want it to be. Think about it. There's always an advancement of technology that does put some people out of jobs. The wheel put people out of jobs. You know, computers put people out of jobs.
Look, we all create them, right, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, look how architects were working even 40 years ago. You know, there were no CAD drawings online and, you know, on computers and stuff like that. So there's always going to be an advancement of technology. It's how we embrace it and use it rather than just roll over and die from it.
I think exactly that. The easiest comparison, I guess, is when the World Wide Web came about, you know, when we've switched from all that stuff. And you know, over that period of time, and it's like, yes, people lost their jobs, but jobs were created.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we'll start to see with AI, is that jobs will go, jobs will be created, the industry will evolve and move on. Of course it will, but I think we're conflating two things where AI can assist and probably will change jobs in production.
Yeah.
Don't know if it's going to replace anyone coming up with ideas. The way ideas are created, the way big ideas are created, I don't think any different now really to what they were in the 60s.
I think the majority of the best ideas I've ever had have come through experience, and that experience of just over time, or experience of actually something happening to me and then me going, fucking hell, that's a great idea. Or you see something, or you interact with something. You cannot replace that.
Well, I'm coming into Manchester this morning and I saw all the TaskRabbit stuff, and you see it and you're like, if anyone's seen the TaskRabbit stuff, they'll know what I mean. But they're using lyrics from songs, repurposing them in a really creative, really funny way to talk about people that can do tasks around your house. And I'm following some buses today on the way in. I'm laughing in my car at how great these lines are. And AI could produce the ads. AI could do the typesetting. It could probably put the person in the ad, whatever, but can't come up with that idea.
No.
And it also can't write the songs that you're then referencing back to. The production side of it, AI is probably coming into that area quite heavily, or will do. But I don't think it's ever going to scratch the surface of the genuine human creativity behind the ideas. So we've got two things on the table. We've got exclamation marks and we've got guff about AI. What I'm going to do is allow you to banish one forever and take one as what I'll call a dishonourable mention. Which one do you want to commit for good?
Oh, God, that is so tough. This is like Sophie's Choice. Got to get rid of it forever. Okay, I'm going to get rid of the exclamation mark forever because I stand on business and that one has annoyed me for a long time. Yep. The AI one, I'm just hoping that common sense kicks in and people just stop panicking about it.
So if we're banishing exclamation marks, we're going to put the guff about AI taking people's jobs as a dishonourable mention.
Yeah.
While you're here, before you go, is there anything that you want to bring back to the marketing world?
Oh, I think I've probably just said it there, but common sense. I think there is there's a lot of preciousness. And I think we are so worried as people, a society, certainly an industry, of offending now, that we almost sacrifice the amazing idea for a good idea.
Yeah.
I was writing some copy this week for a client and I gave them three options. I said, this is the one you should go with. I know you're going to pick one of the other two.
Yeah.
And they did. They picked one of the other two because we are just so scared of offending. And it's very similar to people that we work with when it comes to like LinkedIn content and, you know, their personal brands and stuff. Everyone is so scared of what other people think, but everybody thinks that. Everyone is so worried about what other people think. Nobody is thinking about anybody. And I think unless you are a really awful, nasty dickhead, you're never going to say anything that is that rude or is that offensive, and certainly shouldn't ever be offensive on purpose. But I just think there's not enough common sense. I think there's too much, oh, but what about this and what about that? Well, okay, well, what about a million other things as well? Like, at some point you've got to take the leap, and if you just keep watering it down, well, fuck it, you might as well make AI do it.
I couldn't agree more. And I think obviously common sense is such a broad idea, but I think the way that you've positioned it there, this idea of we're missing great ideas and really effective work because we are over exaggerating all in our minds, potentially just overthinking all the risks.
You mentioned Nick before, who's just an absolute top lad. He has a book that has loads of sayings in it, and it's basically things that he's either overheard or people have said. There's a few of mine in there as well. But I think the best one he ever said was someone had said to him, what's the best thing that can happen? And no one ever thinks of it like that. Everyone thinks, what's the worst thing that can happen? The reality is that's probably not going to happen anyway. So why not aim for the absolute best thing? And if you fall short of that, it's still probably not going to be the worst thing that happened.
I really like that, because it's something that Kev Chester, a previous guest, talks a lot about, which is the idea that humans are naturally more motivated to avoid risk than we are motivated to pursue success. I think it's to the tune of about 2 to 1. That's why we're still alive, right? That's why we weren't eaten by lions. It's why we avoided eating certain foods. We're more motivated to avoid the risk than we are to pursue success. It's what I bang on about it to clients all the time. You know, when you're at shelf edge and you're about to make a purchase, people don't need a nudge to inspire them to make that purchase. What they usually need is remove the risk from the purchase. I think that we need to start taking our own medicine a little bit with this, don't we? Like, marketers will find every reason not to go with something rather than the one reason to go with it. If we were to put a choice to people, would you rather connect strongly with 50% of people or be ignored by 100%?
I could not agree more. And again, when we're talking to people about LinkedIn and that whole kind of personal strategy, what we say to them is there's a billion people on LinkedIn, right? It is not about getting all of those people to think you're all right. It's about getting a few thousand to think you are fucking class. That is it. And that is how you build community. It's how you build rapport. Mm. It's how you build connection. It's how you become unforgettable.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just that shit AI ad that I was talking about before. You know, we always say, it doesn't matter where the good idea comes from. I don't care whether it's the apprentice who's come up with it or the creative director who's come up with it. A good idea is a fucking good idea. Now, that's not to say that a good idea is the same as an idea that someone hasn't done before. So again, to use another analogy, there is a reason that Mercedes don't make cars with square wheels. And it's not because BMW don't, it's because it's a shit idea. You know, you do have to have that sense check of, is this amazing and no one else has thought of it, or is it shit? But you don't know that until you try and drive a car with square wheels. So we try and tell everybody we work with, we are really going to ask you to be brave with this and step out. We've just been working for 12 months with a property client, brand new in Manchester, really, you know, in a competitive market. It's a brand new neighbourhood that they're creating. One of the first billboards we created was over Ancoats, us too. And, you know, you think that's brave, because everyone fucking loves Ancoats. But, you know, also it's big. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, we showed them that and they're like, fucking hell. But it will definitely get traction. And we're not going out there saying all the people in Ancoats are shit and have made a bad decision. We're joking, having fun, you know, with a bit of northern humour.
And also, people who are living in Ancoats right now probably aren't the target audience. The target audience is, you're probably trying to encourage people to live in a certain area. Exactly. You know,
but 100%.
You know, think about who are you trying to target?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, does it matter if some people might scoff at the ad if they're not the audience?
But I bet people take pictures.
You're not going to offend them to a point of upsetting them, are you? Yeah. Like, they're just going to be like, all right, whatever. So We're banishing exclamation marks. We're dishonourable mentioning guff about AI. We're bringing back common sense. That's all now done. How does that make you feel?
Feel great.
Feel good. A lot of people think about this as like brand therapy or marketing therapy. And I think that's kind of why I set the podcast up in the first place.
Yeah.
Before you go, I have one question for you. So every episode, my brother who doesn't work in the industry sends me a question.
Okay.
He sends me a random question every week. My brother, I can never describe it, but my brother works for a company called Arrow that do something with networking, security, computers, IT, the words that I think he works in. He's explained this to me. He's worked there for 10 years.
My brother's a stand-up comedian. That's a much easier
option. So my brother's one of the most funny, creative people I've ever known.
Yeah.
And he works in this job that I still have after 10 years. I've no idea how to understand it.
Yeah, but I bet he says you just like colour in for a living or something.
My
own sister once messaged me and said, "Hiya, I need a hand. Do you know anybody that does marketing?" And I was just what do you think I do? I think people probably don't understand what we do in
it. Yeah, we assume it, don't we? I mean, my stepdad started showing me videos of somebody called Rory Sutherland. I know who this guy is.
Yeah.
But he sent me a question. So he's asked, you were born down south.
Oh, he's done his homework on me then.
He always does. Always does his homework. So you were born down south.
Yeah.
Your dad's from Manchester.
Yeah.
Mum from Yorkshire.
Yes.
Rank those places in order from best to worst.
Fucking hell. Did he not want me to get invited to Christmas? Okay, I'm going to say Manchester, Yorkshire, down south. Quite easy for me, actually.
How come that's so easy? Because that seemed to come really naturally. What's thinking?
So, all my dad's family still live up here. In fact, my brother lives here. My sisters live here. We all live up here. From probably the moment I could speak, I just wanted to live in Manchester. And I couldn't have told you why. I just wanted to. I guess it's because we've got a massive family. All our family were up here. And we were constantly up here. I'm one of 30 grandchildren on one side. So loads of cousins and stuff. So I just loved being up here. I love the atmosphere. I think this city is the most incredible city in the UK. I've also been fortunate prior to starting Co & Co. I was in the property industry. And I've seen it grow. And I've seen it really flourish. And I just think there is... there's something about this city that is so special. Yorkshire, I couldn't put it last. So,
whereabouts in Yorkshire is the family connection?
She's actually from Wensleydale, proper Yorkshire Dale.
Brilliant.
She learned to drive a tractor before she learned to drive a car.
Amazing.
And she was Miss Milkmaid 1970 something.
That's a thing.
Yeah. We've got pictures and everything. She's proper lass from the Dales, Wellies kind of person, which was great as a kid because we could be as messy and, you know, do whatever we wanted. And if we wanted to go out and make mud pies all day, that was fine. If we wanted to come in and take all the cushions off the sofa and build forts and eat our tea in it, that was totally cool as well. And then, down south, I think I probably wanted to leave by the time I was about 11. I mean, obviously, I was born there. I lived there for the first 19 years of my life. So I've nearly lived up here, away from the south, for as long as I lived there. But I feel no affinity to it. I don't really go back much. I don't feel any connection to it. I hate London. You know, I grew up in a really nice area in the middle of the countryside in Buckinghamshire. But it's just, this feels like home. And I think that's what it's interesting he says that, because when people meet me, if they follow me on LinkedIn or whatever, everyone expects me to be Northern.
Yeah.
And I'm probably the least Southerner you could ever
feel. Like that. I think I'll agree with you on the greatness of Manchester as a city. I'll disagree on
as someone not from
actually, I'm from Barnsley, so I'll agree on Manchester being this one of the best cities in the country.
I'd call it a mecca. Certainly has felt like that the last 10 days with the Oasis stuff going on.
And you've got the cricket on here as well at the minute, which is always a good crack at Old Trafford. So I will disagree on Yorkshire not being top, but this is your choice. But what I like is North versus South. North's conquered. We'll agree on that one. How can people get hold of you, Jordan?
So we are coandco.com if you want to head over to our website, or via myself on LinkedIn, Jordan Stacchini.
Great. Thank you for coming in. It's been
great. Thank you. Thanks so much.
So that was my conversation in Marketing Room 101 with Jordan Stacchini. Thank you very much for listening. If you enjoyed it, I'd love it if you could please just send it to one other person. And if you've done anything recently that you feel guilty about, for example, if you were the person who kicked Ozzy Osbourne off the office Spotify in favour of Sabrina Carpenter the day after he died, then remember you can get yourself some instant good karma to balance it out by leaving a review of Marketing Room 101 wherever you get your podcasts. And finally, if you'd like to arrange a free chat about how I and the Principles team can help grow your brand, just find me on LinkedIn under my name, Ben Norman. And if you'd like to know more about Principles, just head to principlesagency.co.uk.